when we're telling these stories, we're translators. And in some cases, you may not have close Asian American friends. And then you turn on the Netflix box or whatever you use, your Apple TV, your Roku, whatever it is, and it's kind of a friendly way in.
Writer-producer Alan Yang went from Parks and Rec to Master of None and Forever. We get his inside take on the rapidly changing TV business. That's today on The Frame Weekend. And whether it's Star Wars or Shakespeare, Daisy Ridley says it's all about the joy of pretending.
I really just like my job. Like, first and foremost, I love to pretend to be someone else.
And 50 years after Stonewall, we've got a story about the largely unknown music of the early gay liberation movement. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. Stay with us. I'm John Horn, and welcome to The Frame Weekend. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do, and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. A little later today, a Toni Morrison documentary that does right by the Nobel Prize winner. But first, the new trailer for the next Star Wars movie starts with a close-up of Daisy Ridley's face.
We've passed on all we know.
She's got a lightsaber in her right hand and conviction in her eyes.
1,000 generations live in you now.
And then she starts running like an Olympic sprinter. She is a badass.
But this is your fight.
But before that Star Wars movie arrives at the end of the year, Ridley will play another pretty spirited young woman. The film is called Ophelia, and Ridley plays the title character. It's a period film about Hamlet's romantic partner. But unlike how she was written by Shakespeare, this Ophelia isn't some passive wallflower. Like Rey in Star Wars, she's an equal to, if not sometimes better than, all the men around her.
It's important to see characters who are just doing the right thing, sometimes for themselves. Like, Ophelia isn't telling people that she's going against the court. She isn't telling people that they're wrong, that she doesn't agree. She just does her own thing. She plots her own escape. She makes the right choice for her. And ultimately, her child.
I have seen more of heaven and hell than most people dream of.
And I think there's power in small statements of moral consciousness.
But I was always a willful girl and followed my heart and spoke my mind. And it is high time I should tell you my story myself.
I think it's also true that with certain plays, and I would put Hamlet, I'd certainly put Othello in that category, that plays that are written 400 years ago actually take on new meaning in the contemporary world. And I think Ophelia's point, and what feels really topical, is that she is not as much bothered by betrayal as she is by what I'll call toxic masculinity.
Yeah. And I think the thing I found, and I actually remember doing the scene with George because I found it very moving, is her saying,
"Not every story must end with a battle."
Hamlet then and there has the choice to do what he promised.
I swore vengeance.
You swore to love me and be mine.
I am yours. I will follow you.
And it wouldn't be difficult for him to put down the sword and say, "You know what, I'm just not going to." Like, he feels some sort of obligation, whether that's to himself, whether that's to the people that have pushed him down, as it were. And that really is the thing that she doesn't wait around for.
Goodbye, my love.
And I found that very moving, because she doesn't say to Hamlet, "I'm going away." Like, if he chose to see what she was saying to him, he would see that she's saying goodbye. But ultimately, it's not her job to get through his emotional armor.
We're talking with Daisy Ridley about her new movie, Ophelia. Ophelia is independent. She's strong. She's not truly satisfied with taking a back seat. Those feel like qualities that are shared by other characters you've played. And I wonder if that's something that you gravitate toward or is important to you, or do you even see much commonality in the roles that you choose?
I think I see commonality between, I guess, Rey and Ophelia, because I think their paths are set by them, regardless of the outside pressures they have.
When you have a movie as successful as a Star Wars movie, that obviously, I would think, opens some doors in terms of what you are offered or what you might be able to do. But is it also limiting in that people might only see you in a certain kind of role?
The thing I found, I had a meeting with a couple producers recently, and I did say, because there are things that have popped up that people are doing in England, and I'm like, oh, I never even read that script. And I did say to these two particular people, I was like, is it that people don't think I can do the job, or like, is it because I seem unavailable? And their thing was that I seem unavailable, I guess, because I did this big, as a lot of people call it, like an American thing. The one thing that I'm looking to do is like a smaller English thing. You know, Ophelia was tiny in comparison, and it's fantastic.
And that brings up another question, that there is certainly something that you take away from working on a big project like Star Wars about acting. They're not really equivalent classes or instruction on being famous. And I'm wondering if you had some advice along the way that has helped you deal with celebrity.
I met Emma Watson for a drink just after I did Star Wars, because someone who worked on Star Wars worked with her a lot. And we went to like a restaurant in Covent Garden, and it was pretty chill. And I was super surprised, because obviously she's like mega famous. And I travel on the tube, I travel on the bus. You do realize over time that if you want to live a quieter life, which I do, it is possible.
We talk a lot on this show about representation and why it matters. And when I think about Ophelia or Rey in Star Wars, one of the things that I think is really important is that if you were a young boy growing up in the 70s and the 80s and you saw Luke Skywalker, you could imagine yourself as a Jedi. But if you're a young girl, you didn't quite have that kind of role model. And I'm wondering if you think it is important, or if you almost feel some sort of obligation to make sure that younger people can look at a character like Rey or Ophelia and say, I like who that person is. Even if I don't want to become an actor, it's important for me to see somebody who looks like me reflected on screen doing the kinds of things I want to do.
Yes, I absolutely think it's important. Even things like the fact that Rey wears trousers. Like, it's badass. She needs to wear trousers, so she wears trousers. And I think somebody came up to me and said, oh, my son wants to run like Rey. And it seems such a tiny thing, but for a little boy to be saying it is also really big. And also, like, she's running, and she's really running, like, on an adventure for her life, whatever that may be. I absolutely think that's really important.
You underestimate Skywalker and Ben Solo. And me. It will be your downfall.
And that's one thing I did not foresee. Because going into it, I just thought this is an awesome role. I had an awesome time. And then the reaction from people, especially with children and people that have said, if there was a character like this growing up, how amazing it would be. But also then it's weird because really, like, you know, Rey would exist. If someone else had been cast, Rey would still exist, but someone else would have brought her to life. It's not me that changed the narrative. I'm very lucky to have played it.
Daisy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Daisy Ridley next stars in Ophelia. Her Star Wars movie comes out at the end of the year. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. So joining me now is Kyle Buchanan. He's the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. And he decided to ask a couple dozen people in Hollywood if the movies can survive the next 10 years.
You know, I think even the most casual movie lover is aware that things are changing, not just because we have Netflix sort of transforming the way that we watch these things, but there's a lot of other streaming services on the way. We have, you know, a movie industry that is dominated by superhero films, and increasingly smaller films are struggling to get noticed. And honestly, I think a lot of young would-be moviegoers are having their brains somewhat rewired by the model of binge watching, the model of watching things on YouTube or Instagram. So there's a whole lot of things happening all at once.
I want to ask you about the kinds of people you were looking for, because like a movie or a TV series, you kind of cast this with an interesting bunch of people. What were you looking for, and was there a common denominator?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, these are sort of discussions and topics that have been bubbling up, and people have kind of been talking around them or just talking to themselves. But I really noticed right after Green Book won Best Picture, Steven Spielberg made a comment about how he hoped that the Academy would recognize that Netflix movies should be eligible for the Emmy and not the Oscar. And that really set off a firestorm online, especially on social media, with people sort of decrying him as out of touch. So I thought, well, let me get a whole lot of these voices. Let me get people for whom, you know, the current blockbuster system is set up to work. And let me get people who are, you know, experimenting or trailblazers in the streaming arena. And what I found to be surprising is that almost all of the filmmakers I talked to, whether they are, you know, theatrical devotees or they're doing stuff for Netflix, you know, they're cognizant of how fast things are changing.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting is you talk to a lot of people who are typically not well represented in Hollywood, and that's women and people of color. John Chu, the director of Crazy Rich Asians, Lena Waithe, who is a writer-producer. She has an upcoming movie called Queen and Slim. Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk. And it felt like they see a real opportunity that they have felt, and people like them have felt, that the barriers to entry were really high. And now with so many streaming services and different outlets, that more voices are getting a chance to tell stories. Is that something you took away from your interviews?
Absolutely. On both sides of the equation, whether it's theatrical or streaming, you know, what was striking about doing this project is how I would say almost every single person out of the 24 I talked to mentioned Jordan Peele. And they use him as an avatar for different things. You know, the people who believe in the power left in the theatrical movie-going system would talk about how people do go to the theaters for Jordan Peele to see his original movies. But what a lot of people were talking about is that, you know, he signals sort of a renaissance for Black filmmakers, and that's really making studios wake up to the idea that this is an underserved audience and that there are underserved audiences, as Crazy Rich Asians proved last summer. And that maybe if you're looking for a way to get people to theaters to reawaken this movie habit or to awaken it at all in people who don't feel that, the way to do that is to let themselves see themselves on that very big screen.
We're talking with Kyle Buchanan from the New York Times about his piece, How Will the Movies as We Know Them Survive the Next 10 Years? I'm wondering, when you went into this story, you've been around this business good enough time. Mm-hmm. Did you have certain assumptions that were challenged? And did all of these interviews start to change your way of thinking about the business?
Somewhat. it made me a little more scared at the pace that this is all happening. I mean, it was evident to me that this was happening very fast. But yeah, you know, I mentioned Steven Spielberg and the whole Netflix-Oscar debate earlier. And I think the reason it fascinated me is because I could kind of see both sides of that equation, you know? I mean, Spielberg is likening Netflix to, you know, a company like HBO, which their movies, and they've had big stars in them, big directors make them, but those are Emmy-eligible. He didn't understand why Netflix should be sort of eroding the sort of sacred idea of what a movie is, or a theatrical movie at least, by contending for Oscars. And to some extent, I was like, he doesn't not have a point, especially because Netflix would often muddy the waters by taking these movies that they got Oscar eligibility for and then turning them around and trying to get them Emmy nominated too. But at the same time, the more I spoke to people like Ava DuVernay or Lena Waithe or, you know, people who'd been working in streaming, the idea that movie going is one of our most populist activities where everybody can race to the theater that's right by them and have these rosy memories, it's not quite the case for everybody in this country. Ava likes to say that you can't watch Straight Outta Compton in Compton because there's no movie theater there. And she had a difficulty finding movie theaters like in Selma, for Selma. So this has not always been a habit that everyone could afford or, you know, could come by as easily as, you know, maybe people think. And when you put it that way and you think about the Netflix subscription costing, you know, as much a month as one movie ticket does, then you understand why it's more available to people. I also noticed when Bird Box was such a gigantic hit on Netflix, there were a lot of people who were being introduced to the male lead of that movie, Trevante Rhodes, for the very first time.
Even though he was in Moonlight.
Yeah, well, even though he was in Moonlight, which won Best Picture.
So from what you gathered, what is the value of keeping movie theaters around?
I mean, that's a tough question, right? To me, movie theaters at their best, it's this incredible communal experience that we're going to have less and less of as things become more online. There are so few places where you can go and sit amidst your neighbors or the other people in your city and feel like embiggened by an experience, an emotional experience that you're sharing with them. You might not be looking straight in their faces, but there is that sense that we get, you know, when you can tell how an audience is reacting, whether they're laughing, whether they're scared, or whether there's this little gasp at a twist. And when I think about the movies I love, that's often such an inextricable part of my memory, is remembering how other people saw it. And I just don't know that that's the same if we watch it on a TV set. And I think the distractions are way, way, way greater. A movie can't quite command our whole undivided attention if we're watching it on a television set as opposed to a theater.
Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. He's the author of the article, How Will the Movies As We Know Them Survive the Next 10 Years? Kyle, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, Himesh Patel, whose character decides to steal all the Beatles songs in the new film Yesterday. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. In the 1980s, if you were a woman who wanted to be a competitive sailor, like Tracy Edwards did, you had one option, and that was to be a cook on a boat.
So when I started Maiden, I did it for a very selfish reason, which was because I didn't want to sail around the world as a cook with 17 men ever again as long as I lived. And I wanted to sail around the world with a bunch of girls.
So she organized her own boat and called it Maiden and entered it into the Whitbread Race around the world.
It's 33,000 miles long. It is the ultimate person against the elements.
While she was battling waves, she shot footage on board. That footage and some archival interviews and new interviews have been put together in a new documentary called Maiden. Tracy Edwards and the film's director, Alex Holmes, came into the Frame Studios to talk about what Tracy Edwards accomplished.
And, you know, in the film, there's a, which I find a hugely embarrassing moment where someone says to me, are you a feminist? And my little 22-year-old self says, oh, no, I hate the word feminist. And then, of course, later on in the race, I think, yeah, I am. I think I'm a very big feminist. And because I'd grown to understand the meaning of the word, you know, it wasn't this horrible thing that men had made it. It means equality and fairness. And do I want equality and fairness? Yes, I do.
Alex, I want to ask you about making this film. And were you familiar at all with the Maiden or this race? How did you stumble upon it and become interested in it?
Well, I came upon it purely by chance. My daughter was leaving elementary school, and that year the school had arranged to have a guest speaker, and the guest speaker was Tracy. And I knew straight away when she started to speak that she was a remarkable character. That's obvious to anybody who meets Tracy. But as her story unfolded, I was just blown away by how gripping the story was, but also how inspiring. I was sitting there looking at my 11-year-old daughter, you know, eyes wide, hearing Tracy tell her tale. And it just struck me that this was, would make an incredible film. I mean, I should say that when I heard it, I assumed that the way to tell this would be in a dramatic form because...
I mean, as a narrative, not a
documentary. As a narrative, exactly.
Well, because I suspect we'll soon get that.
Because, this happened in 1989. There were no iPhones around. How was there going to be any footage of all these dramatic events that Tracy described? And it was only later that Tracy told me that they had had a camera on board the whole way around and this footage existed somewhere. So the prospect of making a doc raised itself.
So Tracy, who was shooting this footage? Was it various members of the crew? And why were you shooting so much? Because there's incredible footage of so many key moments in the race, some, you know, doldrums where nothing's happening, and then some incredible storm footage. There's leaks. There's all sorts of things that are happening that you're documenting.
So the Whitbread said they wanted volunteer boats to take cameras. And most of the men's boats went, oh, no, we're roughy-tufty ocean sailors. We're not filming. We're here to compete. And we stuck our hand up and went, we'll film, because we knew instinctively that, you know, we never had a doubt that we were going to get round. We thought we were going to do well. So we thought we need to document this for the next, you know, generation or whatever. And so they gave us a camera. We then fixed a camera on the radar mast, which no other boat had, so that when we all needed all hands on deck, we could hit the panic button on the way out and we would film, you know, whatever was happening. And then so Joe, who was the cook and my lifelong friend from the age of 12, who was the cook on the boat, she said, I'm not doing a watch, so I'll film. So we said, right, go and get some training, sent her off for a few days training. And she came back with this huge, the cameras were massive at the time, obviously. And she...
And Jo isn't particularly big herself, so...
Yeah, no, Jo's tiny, like me. And it just, she just had a knack. And, you know, and Alex has said to me, it is a lot of the success of this documentary is due to her filming, because she filmed everything. I mean, she drove us nuts. We wanted to throw her overboard a couple of times, but she kept filming, and she learned ways to not let us see that she was filming, which is how you get those candid shots of us not really realizing that we're under scrutiny.
We're talking with Alex Holmes, the director of Maiden, and Tracy Edwards, who is the subject of the film. Very little of the media coverage of the race was focused on tactics. Instead, it was about the gender of the crew. I want to play a clip from the film, and this is the bowman, Jenny Mundy.
If you looked at the questions or the articles written about us at the time, they were always digging for stories on, well, who's boyfriend, girlfriend? Are you lesbians? Are you sleeping around? Or surely you're not getting on that well? Bunch of women on a boat that size. There must be a lot of squabbles.
What about the crew? A bunch of girls. How'd you all get on?
Remarkably well.
You never saw them ask the guys those questions. They would be asked about tactics, challenges, you know, sail, sensible sporting questions. We almost never got asked those questions.
Well, I'm going to ask you, Tracy, because the boat does incredibly well, and a lot of that is owing to the tactics of the team.
I think the reason we did so well is because we had so much to overcome to get to the start line. So when we got to the start line, we'd had 3 years of battling to get there, and that had drawn us together as one. And I found on when I was sailing around the world with 17 guys, there was a lot of competition between them. And not always to the best effect of, you know, to affecting us in a good way. Whereas when you have a bunch of girls, I think there's less, well, there were no egos. We all knew we were learning on the job, and me in particular. And I just had amazing support and backup from my watch captains, both of whom were amazing tacticians. And there's a difference between the navigation and the tactics. So my love is navigation.
And can I just add there that I think some of the brilliant navigational decisions that Tracy made are baked into her character, because Tracy is not someone who accepts that things are the way that they are and they have to be that way. She questions, why does it have to be that way? Why do we have to follow that course? Why can't we follow a different course? And I think some of your most brilliant decisions were where you decided to, well, they may all be heading off over that way, but I'm going to take this route because I think that's the one to back.
Alex Holmes is the director of Maiden. Tracy Edwards is the subject of the film. It's in theaters now. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. We're joined now by Paul Ratliff, who is our intern. Hey, Paul.
Hello.
So tell us what you brought down.
So I just finished a piece on the music of the gay liberation era. So that refers to basically the about 15 years after the Stonewall riots.
1969.
This week is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And the Stonewall riots, a lot of people think that that's the beginning of the modern gay rights movement. And it's really not that. But it is an important event. And it occurs right in the middle of a transition between an earlier, more kind of conservative gay rights movement and a more kind of radical period of activism. And that period of activism had a soundtrack, basically, that not a lot of people know much about.
Let's give it a listen.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey.
After Stonewall, queer musicians felt empowered to start openly singing about being queer.
When the Stonewall uprising happened in June of 1969, I was in Missoula, Montana. I heard it on the radio. Homosexuals were rebelling in New York City.
That's Patrick Haggerty. In 1972, his band, Lavender Country, recorded one of the earliest openly queer albums of the era. It's also the first gay country album. For Patrick, news of the Stonewall Rebellion was liberating.
I came out immediately, as soon as I heard the call from Stonewall. I mean, it was like the next day. I went, this is it. This is my call. This is where I make a move.
It don't matter here who you love or what you wear.
The Lavender Country record also reflects the radical politics of the gay liberation movement.
The Stonewall Rebellion took place during a radical period in American history. It was connected to the anti-Vietnam War movement, the women's movement. The Black Panthers were very active at this time. Many of us in the Stonewall era were looking for a total transformation of the way society was organized. Rise up.
Lavender Country, like most queer music of the time, was produced outside the commercial music industry.
When I made Lavender Country, I was not aware of any other gay musician.
What Patrick didn't know is that a group of radical lesbian feminists in Washington, D.C. was about to take the independent production of queer music a step further. Here come the lesbians, here come the leaping lesbians. They were about to found one of the most important institutions in the gay music movement of the 1970s, Olivia Records.
She was a big, tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female meant you still could be strong.
Founded in 1973, Olivia Records sold millions of albums. The label was run entirely by women, and they made music that spoke directly to the experience of gay women in particular. Their signature work is a record called The Changer and the Changed by Olivia co-founder Chris Williamson. And the song Sweet Woman was a revelation for many gay women who'd never heard their relationships reflected in song. Chris Williamson spoke at last year's Americana Music Association's Honors and Awards show about the impact Sweet Woman had on the women who heard it.
Women told us the most amazing stories. In those days, they wrote letters. Women who wrote to me that when they heard Sweet Woman, women nearly drove off the road because they were weeping so hard and they had to pull off to the side of the road because they realized it was a song from a woman to a woman.
Meanwhile, 17 members of a men's collective in New England called the Walls to Roses Collective recorded an album to explore the meaning of masculinity. When their album, Walls to Roses, Songs for Changing Men, came out in 1979, it contained a song that would become an anthem in the gay liberation movement, a song called Gay Spirit by Charlie Murphy.
There's a gay spirit singing in our hearts, leading us through these troubled times.
Walls to Roses was conceived with an emphasis on inclusion. The collective hired female musicians, engineers, and even photographers to make the record, and it also featured a pioneering black gay singer-songwriter with the gender-neutral name Blackberry.
We choose to love each other only openly gay.
The album closes with a Blackberry song that stresses the importance of what we would now call intersectionality.
A lot of my music is about coalition building. My song on Walls of Roses was about racism, gay rights, and ERA. The song basically says, we've got to win together for things to get better. Me, you know, we're not going to do this by ourselves. We have to support each other's struggles. That's what I've always preached, I guess you could say.
We lost in Eugene. When will the ignorance end? When will humankind learn to be friends?
Blackberry and Patrick Haggerty from Lavender Country have been friends for more than four decades. The music they each made outside of the mainstream recording industry, along with albums from Olivia Records and others, gave a nation of queer people a soundtrack to their lives and to their activism. Haggerty had this to say about the network of queer musicians that formed during the gay liberation era.
I've been iconized a lot. Turned into some kind of something that I'm not. And I'm reflecting then and now, if you were being public about being gay during those years, whether anybody called you that or not, all of us were icons.
For The Frame, I'm Paul Ratliff.
Gay is natural, gay is good, gay is wonderful, gay people should all come.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. What if, thanks to some bizarre worldwide blackout, the Beatles never existed and only one person remembered the band's music? That's the high concept idea behind the new film Yesterday. It's written by Richard Curtis and directed by Danny Boyle. The film stars Himesh Patel as Jack. He's a struggling singer-songwriter, but after the global power grid goes haywire, he alone knows all the songs by the Beatles.
You know, it starts off fairly normally, you know, and then this crazy thing happens about 10 pages in, and everything gets turned on its head.
I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
What the hell was that?
Yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
The Beatles.
The what?
John, Paul, George and Ringo, the Beatles.
I think what people probably should understand is these are not technically covers of Beatles songs. I mean, they are, but they aren't. How would you describe the way that your character, Jack, approaches these songs? Because, again, the conceit is nobody knows them, but it's not as if he's trying to replicate what the Beatles sounded like, is it?
Not only do people not know them, they don't exist. So he has absolutely no reference point for where to even begin. It's all from his mind. So, of course, they're, you know, perhaps in reality one would veer off even further with the lyrics, but you know, we really need to play tribute to these songs, so we don't want to veer too far from them. But at the same time, it meant that we had a freedom to really create our own versions of them, just to see what would happen if we did, what other magic lies within these songs if you just twist this bit here and there.
Something in the way she moves.
And that was the real joy of working with Daniel Pemberton, who was our composer, and his friend Ardem Ilhan, who came in, and we worked together for 2 months basically in this room that we converted in the offices in London to make it look like Jack's bedroom. We put posters up on the wall and a piano and a Wurlitzer and a record player, and I spent 2 months in that room with Ardem just learning the songs.
Somewhere in her smile.
Talking with Himesh Patel about his film Yesterday. So at what point does the actor learning how to play the songs disappear and the character who is reimagining them start to take over?
As soon as the basics are there, as soon as, you know, I can play the song without really thinking about the playing of it, it's the same thing as what actors do. We learn the lines and learn the lines and learn the lines until we're not thinking about the lines. And so it's the same thing with learning the songs. You just keep playing the song and keep playing the song until your fingers don't think about where they need to go next. And so then you can start to draw in Richard's story.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
The songs are just so amazing that you can never separate them from those four. And in a way, that's what we're saying with our film, is that even if they don't exist, you can't recreate them to be anything better.
I'm going to end with a quick quiz. You have been living, thinking, singing Beatles for probably longer than you care to remember right now. I have a couple of songs queued up. You're only going to hear 2 seconds of a couple of Beatles songs.
No.
If you're ready, let's try it.
It's Hard Day's Night. It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. All You Need Is Love.
Very good. 3 for 3.
In My Life.
And the last.
Yeah, I do know that. I feel like I'm having to sing it in my head. Ticket to Ride.
5 for 5. Himesh is batting 1,000. Himesh, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad.
Coming up, producer Alan Yang, who has firsthand accounts of how quickly the television business is changing. That's next on The Frame Weekend.
Remember to let her in.
It's The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There's a documentary in theaters now about the novelist Toni Morrison. It's directed by the filmmaker-photographer Timothy Greenfield Sanders, and it's called Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. When the movie premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January, critic Beyondrea July reviewed it for Out Magazine. Now that it's in theaters, she takes another look at it, this time with the help of a leading expert on Toni Morrison's work.
Toni Morrison's novels were always on my mother's bookshelves growing up. But until I saw the new documentary, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, I didn't know much about the woman who wrote them.
Even when I wrote The Bluest Eye, I was really writing a book I wanted to read. I hadn't seen a book in which black girls were center stage. I wanted to read a book that had no codes, no little notes explaining things to white people. And I had a major, major question in my mind at that time, which was, how does a child learn self-loathing?
The Bluest Eye is the story of Pakola Breedlove, a black girl who thinks having blue eyes will save her from the torment of her daily life. It was Morrison's first published novel, and it's the kind of serious and unflinching work that made it surprising for me to see how funny and carefree Morrison is in the movie. Like in this clip where she's talking about her college days at Howard University. It's the 1950s.
When I got to Howard, I was loose. It was lovely. I just loved it. I'm sure I overdid it, but I don't regret it now.
She's got an amazing sense of humor.
Farrah Jasmine Griffin is a Toni Morrison scholar.
She is one of the most down-to-earth people I know. And yet, you know, she's also genuinely a genius.
Griffin heads the African American and African Diaspora Studies Department at Columbia University. Griffin is interviewed in the film, but she also happens to be one of my favorite professors from when I was in college at the University of Pennsylvania. So after seeing the documentary, I called her up.
The brilliance that we see on the page is always operating, and that those things aren't separate, you know, that they exist all in that one person, that you get that full range of who she is.
It's not that Toni Morrison gets super personal in the film. She really doesn't, actually. She keeps the focus on her public professional life. But director Timothy Greenfield Sanders still manages to maintain a sense of intimate storytelling. He matches the beats of Morrison's life with a stunning array of black visual art. And he wisely makes Morrison the narrator of her own story.
She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man. The pieces I am, she gather them and give them back to me in all the right order. It's good, you know, when you got a woman who is a friend of your mind.
And while the film is an unapologetic celebration of Morrison, it also lets us know that her work wasn't always well received.
When you read early reviews of Toni's work, those early sympathetic liberal reviewers, and I remember one of them about Sula, and the reviewer says, she's got a great talent. One day she won't limit it to only writing about black people. Like, really, it's limiting for her to write about black people? Like, no one says that when, you know, an Irish writer writes about Irish people. You know, it's only limiting when you write about black people.
And when she published her novel Beloved in 1987, almost 50 prominent black writers, including Alice Walker and Maya Angelou, called out the literary establishment for not giving Morrison her due. Here's a clip of a journalist asking Morrison about that in the film.
What is your response? Because now you're sort of caught up in the middle of all of this.
It's easily the most significant thing that has ever happened to me in my writing life. I write out of the culture, as everyone does, for it, through it, and I'm in it. So a portion of that culture said to me, amen.
But even after Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993, the critiques didn't end. The documentary cites critics who said Beloved is a fraud and that the award was an act of political correctness. I looked up the source of these quotes, and to my surprise, they came from black men, cultural critic Stanley Crouch and novelist Charles Johnson, respectively.
Those critiques said more about the people who made them than they said about Morrison's work. Because there was no question in our minds about the literary importance and sophistication of her work. And, you know, these came from talented writers themselves, but it really did lend itself to turn a sort of lens on them and say, why? Why do you need to do this?
Going into the film, I knew that director Timothy Greenfield Sanders was a longtime friend of Morrison's, but he's also a white man. And it seems to me that the director clearly understood he needed black women on his team to properly tell Morrison's story. Like the visual artist Micheline Thomas, she made an inventive custom collage from pictures of Morrison for the film's opening credits. And Greenfield Sanders also brought on producer Sandra Guzman to conduct the interviews. And composer Catherine Bostick wrote and performed an original song for the film.
Walk to the edge and dance with me. Walk to the edge and set yourself free above the water.
After watching the film, what stays with you is Morrison's undeniable presence. And of course, her intellectual brilliance lingers too. But it's precisely those pieces being gathered together that lets the film hit its mark. It's what makes you see that Morrison herself is that friend of my mind that she writes about. She's that friend for all of us. For The Frame, I'm Beyondria July.
The one-eyed man is king. Walk to the edge and dance with me. Walk to the edge and set yourself free.
The documentary, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, is in theaters now. You're listening to The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn.
Above the gathering stones, into ancient arms, above the water. Woo! Woke up this morning, put my feet on the clay. Me and my baby wash these feet away.
So, earlier in the show, we talked about the future of the movie business and how problematic that might be. And one of the main reasons it's in trouble is because there's so much good stuff on TV. Over the course of the summer, we are going to be talking to a lot of people who work in television about the rapidly changing business. Today, it's Alan Yang. He's worked on network shows like NBC's Parks and Rec. And recently, he's been doing a lot of work for streaming sites. Master of None on Netflix, Forever on Amazon. He has a new series coming out on Apple's new platform. He's also in post-production on his first feature film. It's called Tiger Tail. It's based on his own family. He wrote and directed it. And that's where our conversation with Alan Yang starts.
One day, you know, I'm in New York half the time, and I was in New York, and sometimes my dad will come over to my house and to check up on it in L.A. And so I got an email from him, and he said, hey, I let the pest control in. It all went fine. I was like, okay. And then he said, yeah, I saw your movie script on the coffee table, so I just read it.
Oh, my goodness.
So my heart stopped when I got that email. I said, what did you think? He's like, I loved it. It was great. And then he had some historical nitpicks, of course. But it was really a gratifying moment. I remember the moment I opened that email. I was walking home on the street in New York on the Lower East Side. And it was really gratifying. I got a little emotional because it's really personal. You know, I wanted him to see it in the theater. But the fact that he approves is big.
Not to sound like a therapist, but is it possible you left it out on purpose so that your father might discover it?
I didn't want him to see it that way. I wanted him to see the final product. But yeah, at least he didn't hate it. At least he wasn't like, cancel the movie. I'm going to sue you.
When you go back and look at things in your own life, even if you change them and fictionalize them, do you get a new understanding of what happened and start to see things that shaped you, that made you, that you did in a new way? Does fictionalizing in a way make it somehow more truthful to the present?
I think that's a very incisive question, and I think that my answer personally is yes, because a lot of times when you're adapting something from your life into a fictional form, I think you're doing that because you're processing it, right? There's some aspect of it that is therapeutic, but I think you're also processing in a sense that you're making them from a point of view you didn't have necessarily while going through them. So it's nice to tap into the emotions you had while going through the experiences, but you're also a different person. So one of the sort of themes in this movie, Tiger Tail, that I just am finishing up now, is the idea that my generation of Asian Americans, my parents are both immigrants, sometimes have to, for lack of a better word, assimilate into a culture that is not necessarily comprised of people who look like them. And that's a fancy way of saying there weren't a lot of Asian people where I grew up, so I learned to speak other languages, if that makes sense. So I'm only now becoming more sort of interested in that aspect of my life, and the movie touches on that, and it is, I think, a little bit more perceptive than I would have been at the time. You know, I'm not really even a character in the movie, but through the lens of the people of my generation, my sister's character and other characters, you know, in some ways the movie's about reconnecting with your parents, and that's something I only have with perspective now and not through the moments I was going through them.
Does that give you an understanding of how you found your voice as a storyteller, that if you are both trying to assimilate, like, who do I want to be, how do I fit in, and who am I authentically, how do all those things come together to create the person that is going to tell the stories and what that point of view is?
Yeah, that I think that's what makes it hopefully an interesting recipe, because it's something I'm still formulating, you know, intellectually and emotionally. And I've heard so many people have come up to me and said, you know, watching the parents episode of Master of None, or, you know, the Thanksgiving episode, or any of these episodes, where in some ways when we're telling these stories, we're translators, right? We're translators from our own cultures to people who may not be familiar with these cultures. And in some cases, you know, you may not have close Asian American friends. And then you turn on the, you know, your Netflix box or whatever you use, your Apple TV, your Roku, whatever it is. And it's kind of a friendly way in, because it's hopefully entertaining and funny. And at the same time, you're learning a little bit about some, you know, culture that you don't necessarily have contact with. And I think it's all mixed up in what I'm going through, because as I may have mentioned, this was not really a priority of mine when I went into, you know, writing and directing and producing. I didn't think that this would necessarily be a focus of mine, but because it's so important to me personally, it's definitely bled into the work.
We're talking with writer, producer, and director Alan Yang. If you were doing this 15 years ago, you couldn't do it. I mean, that if you were working with ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, you couldn't tell the kinds of stories that you tell on Forever or Master of None, because they were not interested in those stories. Do you have an appreciation for the amount of creative freedom that people like you have today, given what's going on in streaming and cable and even, to a certain extent, broadcast right now?
I can't believe how lucky I am, because I've seen the change. You know, I started on a network show. I started on Parks and Recreation, and that's where I was a baby writer, and that's where I kind of came up. And then all this stuff happened while I was getting to the point where I got my own shows. I mean, that is insane. Basically, when we sold Master of None to Netflix, they had two shows. They had House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. So that's how, quote unquote, early on the train we were. That was only like 5 years ago. It seems like an eternity, where it's all this stuff's taken for granted. But no, look at the shows. As you mentioned, Master of None, which is very much an observational show, starring, you know, an Indian dude, a black lesbian, a Taiwanese guy, and then Forever, which is this sort of David Lynchian, Wim Wendersian comedy that changes forms in each of the first three episodes and is one continuous story and features one episode without any of the main characters in it. And then this Apple show I'm producing, Little America, is an anthology show featuring different immigrant stories. They're all based on real research. And then this movie I'm doing is very much an art house type film that's largely in Mandarin and Taiwanese and is shot on 16mm film. So if you look at some of these shows, you can't believe that they're making them. Russian Doll or Pen 15 or Fleabag or Insecure or Atlanta, or, you know, any of these shows, like, show me that on CBS in 2005. I mean, it just doesn't exist.
Well,
it's just
2015.
Yeah, I mean, no
CBS,
shade on, yeah. CBS, but yeah, I mean, certainly it's changed. It's changed a lot.
I'm going to play a small clip from the first episode of Forever with Maya Rudolph and Fred Armisen.
I don't know why you felt the need to apologize.
Well, you probably could have been a little more patient.
I was being really What would you have done?
I don't know. I wouldn't have pushed him down the hill.
I didn't push him down the hill. He'd lost his balance.
Okay.
Besides, since when are you the defender of little kids? It's a little surprising.
What does that mean?
I just mean you never seem like the biggest fan of little kids, that's all.
I love kids. I get along great with them.
Well, every time we talked about having them, you never seemed that interested.
Whoa.
What Hubbard and I talked about was, can we show Maya and Fred in a light that they haven't been seen before? Can we give them material to play that feels substantively unlike stuff that we've seen them do. We know they're two of the most talented sketch comedians of our time. They're two of the greatest SNL performers of all time. Let's push.
Alan, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you again. Thanks for having me.
And that is what we've got for you this week. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darmi Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin. Valentina Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. And our theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back with the daily version of The Frame on Monday.